Hello and welcome back to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. My guests this morning are staying around for a special web-only edition of Words and Pictures on KBOO to tell us more stories about their trip to Afghanistan, where they showed up as two unembedded journalists who happened to do their reporting in comics form. Welcome back, Ted Rall and Matt Bors.
Thanks for having us.
So we were talking about coming in through Tajikistan. You had to exit through Iran, or you actually had a couple of options.
We could have gone doubled back through Tajikistan. We had a double entry visa. We could have gone out through Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, or Iran, or I guess we could have flown out of Kabul. I mean, if we'd known how the situation was going to be, we probably would have. I mean, the situation was very different than what I anticipated in many respects, and we probably should have just flown in and out of Kabul.
You know, we hear about hikers who accidentally cross into Iran,
not really. Like, from what we heard, this hiker's story is really fishy because
I don't know.
They had to cross, like, well, I looked into it since I got back. They had to cross some giant mountains. It's kind of like accidentally crossing Mount McKinley, you know? So it's really weird because I doubt they're spies, but it's not like really just sort of meandering across the border
adventure
from Washington State to Oregon.
But if they were really curious, they could have done what you did, and it was easy.
Yeah, you can get visas for Iran. It's not as hard as Americans think to go there. But I like doing the whole trip by land. We had to fly over some spots within Afghanistan, but we went out by land into Iran, and they actually said we were the first Americans to cross by land from Afghanistan into Iran since the revolution.
Yeah, that's true.
Because there are
other foreigners who have done it, but not Americans.
Yeah. So I love this, Matt and Ted. You come back to the U.S. after having stamps in your passport from all these former Soviet republics, Afghanistan and Iran, and you would expect the rubber glove treatment at this point.
They should have, honestly. I would have tortured me.
I brought back a bunch of carpets. I declared my carpets and a burqa, and they didn't even open my bag. It was great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, come on, think about it. We have passport stamps from, like, all these countries. It's like, obviously, we should be carrying drugs and weapons and terrorist reading materials or something. But you know, we weren't. But
they did take a bottle of scotch I bought at the Dublin airport.
Fascists.
the tax-free store, the duty-free store.
Otherwise, the sobriety would have won.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about getting the travel visas, because there was at least one visa that was crazy difficult to get. You were just going through bureaucracy and being given the runaround.
Well, that was Iran. And we should mention that we were on this trip with Stephen Cloud, another cartoonist, and he was the one that actually came through and made the Iran trip possible.
He was instrumental. I mean, I'd been trying and I just failed to get the Iran visa. Stephen got it, but it was expensive. I mean, basically, you know, when Matt says you can go to Iran, you can, but it's going to cost you thousands of dollars essentially to arrange the visa alone.
Yeah, you got to go through a travel company. They basically have the lockdown on it, you know.
Oh, so the travel company will not if you book it really far ahead, the travel company will not soak you for the cost.
Well, I don't know. We were in a rush.
You will get soaked no matter what. The deal is that you basically can get the visa if you arrange a tour through an Iranian company and you pay for a very overpriced tour, and then essentially what you're doing is you're buying a visa.
Yeah.
Well, this whole trip through Afghanistan was not a low-cost expedition by any means. But you brought in financing from all over the place, including the Times of India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. The primary financing came from Kickstarter.com.
Oh, really?
Which is a website that allows people to sponsor projects. So I put up a pitch and I asked for $25,000, and people kicked in $26,000. And so that was the lion's share of the money. I kicked in about another 10, and all told, and there was also money from Times of India. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, all told, I think this was probably about a $45,000 trip. And, it feels like about a $40 trip in terms of the luxury aspect. I mean, it's ludicrous.
Yeah.
But your money's just flying out your pocket, like, you know, in terms of airfares and million.
Well, and you had to get cab rides into sketchy areas. You had to do bribes. You have wild stories about the Afghani police. You're not a big fan of the Afghani police.
Well, no one's a fan of the Afghan
police. Especially Afghans.
Yeah, no, the Afghans hate them. I mean, they're you know, one of the reasons that it's hard to get around overland is the neo-Taliban have checkpoints. Pretty much they control about 80 to 90% of the country, everything outside of a few major cities.
At least at night.
At night.
They have kind of like a timeshare agreement. Where the, yeah. The Afghan police are, you know, very lazy and they don't want to put their lives on the line. So they man the checkpoints during the day, and then at night the Taliban come in. They have a shadow. They really have a shadow government that comes into especially the rural areas, run things, kill collaborators, and then, you know, leave during the day.
Of course, sometimes the Afghan National Police are also the Taliban at night. Yeah. So, you know, there's people in these difficult economic times, it's important to moonlight to make extra money. And but the so they're also, the drivers are afraid of being jacked up by the Taliban, but also they're afraid of being jacked up by the Afghan National Police, you know, and robbed and having maybe be kidnapped or have their, at bare minimum, be robbed, have their car stolen maybe, who knows what. But anyway, it's bad. The cops are worthless.
Now, you know? Ted, if you go, if the listeners go on your travel blog, your Afghanistan blog at tedrawl.com, there's some hilarious cartoons about the Afghani police, and they sort of have these Inspector Clouseau outfits that you make a lot of fun with.
Yeah, the hats kind of look like French KPs, but I think the best comparison is if you watch that show Lost, the Dharma Initiative jumpsuits seems to be like sort of with a lot of pockets, kind of like
excessive.
A lot of pockets. I wanted to count the number of pockets, but I don't know if numbers go that high.
So it's almost like the occupational force is trying to humiliate them or something.
Yeah, well, it's true that, like, you know, the look of your uniform really affects your attitude. I mean, I'm a New Yorker, and for many years we had traffic cops and who wore brown uniforms, and they were called brownies. And, you know, that's not really a very dignified look. And then they changed them. They brought them into the regular police force and gave them regular blue uniforms. And it's amazing how, like, they don't get punched out as much. They get more respect. And I think it's the same thing in Afghanistan.
Yeah, the Afghan ones are like a grayish blue. I mean, they're not real into bright colors in general in their wardrobes. But, yeah, it's pretty drab color. And they just sit around.
They're like custodians.
They kind of sit around. You know, there's a ton of them in Kabul. Every corner has five policemen with AK-47s slung over their shoulders, but they just sit around texting, yelling at you if you take pictures of stuff because they don't want, you know.
And you'd get shaken down for money once in a while?
Not so much by the police, more...
Our drivers do.
Yeah, more just people that we had financial transactions with. A deal is not a deal in Afghanistan, in the third world. You know, I mean, you agree to a certain amount of money for a drive, and then, you know, you're for an 8-hour drive, and then, you know, you're a half hour away from your destination, the guy starts saying, oh, this is a $300 trip? No, $150, remember? And then, you know, it's...
And you had to change your itinerary a number of times, and it turned out there were some sections that you planned to go through by car that nobody would take you for any price, and you had to fly.
Yeah, that's right. We had to... Basically, that's what Afghans do. If you have the money, you have to fly. You have to hopscotch if you want to go from... Say,
so you get these puddle jumpers like you get across Montana or something like that.
Yeah.
And the reason that they were kind of puzzled that we wanted to do it because as foreigners with money, it's not expensive to fly. It was under $100 each to fly from Kabul to Herat. You know, it was a 2-hour flight. We're talking about a 4-day drive over the Hindu Kush mountain range. But we wanted to do it. And nobody would take us because of the reasons Ted cited earlier. They were afraid of the Taliban attacks. And then coming back, they have to drive back 4 days with all the money we gave them. It's going to be taken by the police.
Yeah, there's almost no point. That's the really grim part about what's going on. I mean, what good are the new highways if you can't use them because they're controlled by corrupt cops and talibs?
We did tempt ourselves by going into a motorcycle shop and checking out some bikes. We were going to do it ourselves.
We would have done it, except that, like, Cloud was sick. And, actually, no, Matt was sick.
I was sick.
And we would have, then, like, after he started to feel better, he was like, we would do it.
I mean, you knew you were going to get sick.
Oh yeah.
I always get sick.
We all did. I got it the worst, probably, for sure.
I remember you talked about the food. You just said the food.
Yeah, you know, it's
bizarre.
Hard to say. It's not that we had any food that was probably like underprepared or dirty or anything. It's just not great tasting.
That's a very low key way to say it.
We drink bottled water the whole time, so it's hard to say. You know what you get sick from. You're in the third world. It's anything and everything.
What about the eggs with black spots, though?
Yeah, well, you got to not eat those. So we were in hotels.
I did not follow that
sometimes
rule.
Sometimes we had Afghan food that was of varying quality. And
although it's never good.
No, it's never great. Although the first time we got it, when we got into Talikon, we had kebabs.
You have to come back here.
They
for
were
good Afghani
they were
food.
Great.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the food. That's like people don't know. They're like, I've been to an Afghan restaurant. Sure you have.
I was kind of digging.
Like Cuban food here is great.
I was digging the kebabs in Afghanistan, and then we got to Iran. We had real kebabs that were awesome, and I was like, oh, okay, I understand now. That was.
Crap.
Yeah.
I love the pizza cartoon on Ted's blog.
Yeah, well, there's
pizza
this like.
Is so weird.
There's an attempt to imitate Western food because American culture is so popular elsewhere. And also in the hotels, they try to give you Western food and it just ends. It just turns out badly. The hard boiled eggs, I don't know if a hard boiled egg is Western, but you know, you crack them open and there's black spots. It's like, how do you mess up a hard boiled egg?
It's kind of magic.
Tell about the pizza.
I mean, yeah, like there's like the pizza is. Well, it's kind of just sort of like if you gave like a 4-year-old, you know, a picture of pizza and said, I want you to prepare this meal. And so then you end up like, you know, maybe he would throw red crayons in there or something. So it's like in the form of pizza when it's like in a picture from far away. Yeah, it's pizza-ish-ish. But yeah, so there's like there's not really tomato sauce. It's like mysterious red paste. That I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And then not red bean. I couldn't figure it out. None of us could figure it out. And then there really was chicken with a bone on the bone on top, which was my favorite. And then there was okra. You know, that's everyone's favorite.
Fish.
Yeah, the fish.
Don't forget to get pizza with fish
on top
of it.
Landlocked nation.
In a landlocked country.
Yeah, very landlocked. Mm-hmm. And yeah, then there was and then they always threw in the diet mayo and diet ketchup on the side because you know Afghans are very obese from years of
well, starvation. Especially we were there during Ramadan.
You were there during Ramadan, right?
And, no eating during the day.
And so you said sometimes you'd be traveling around and your drivers would start to feel faint in the middle of the day because they hadn't even drunken water.
Oh, by the end of the day, these people are hallucinating. I mean, just imagine. We had these, you know, quaint ideas when we went in. We were like, oh, we're going to respect the culture. We're going to do Ramadan.
Yeah,
and
we're
then like
do it
after the first day, we were like, forget about it.
It's
this
impossible.
This is dumb.
And this
but,
is
you know,
August, too.
The eating is one thing. Some days we just had to, because of circumstance, go without eating until breakfast when the sun went down. But the not drinking thing, I mean, it's impossible. You can't do it. We couldn't do it.
It's 125 degrees, you know? I mean, it's dusty. You're traveling, although apparently there's an exemption in
For travelers.
For travelers, so we're kind of okay.
And non-Muslims are not required to obey it, but you know, just everyone there's Muslim, so there's not really restaurants serving food.
And it's also considered. I mean, it's a little rude when people are like, you know, half crazy with hunger to be like, hey, let me get me one of those quarter pounders.
Although it was funny to see them, they cheat because you have to, otherwise you'll die. So you know, some of our drivers are like slamming cokes and stuff in the
like
car,
like on the highway when there's no one around.
Yeah.
And also, if you go to the bathroom, man, like the bathrooms are piled high with empty water bottles.
But the guy that Joveed that took us from Talikon to Herat. Mazar to Kabul through the Salong Tunnel. That was like an 8-hour trip. He didn't have a sip of water the entire time. It was amazing.
That's true.
It was incredible. We were drinking. We had to. We were like, sorry, man. We gotta take some water.
I seriously think I would have been hospitalized if I hadn't.
But when we got there, we were you know, snacking on power bars or whatever and drinking a little bit. When we got in, we were so beat. I mean, it's exhausting. We're just sitting in a car all day. The heat kills you.
Yeah, the heat is it's unbelievable. I mean, if you think about the worst heat you've experienced, perhaps on a hot summer day in Arizona, it's hotter than that.
And one of the other upshots of Ramadan is that everybody just parties at night after the sun goes down. So you didn't get much sleep.
Oh yeah,
that's the worst.
That's great for us. We were at this dingy hotel in this town called Chagchuan, and you know, we would go walk around all day when they're trying to chill out in the shade. Do our thing, come back when the sun goes down, draw, try to get to sleep at like 10, 11. The lights go on at, you know, 2 in the morning. These people are like screaming. They're slamming doors so loud. It's that you can't sleep. There's flies all over you. And, you know, they're up at 2:30, 3 in the morning. They're eating. And
the flies are different, too. I mean, you know, you see flies. You're like, who cares about flies? No, you don't understand. Like, sometimes they'd like try to pry your eyelids open while you're sleeping so they can walk
like
on your
hang
eyes.
Hang out underneath your
eyelids. Yeah. They're like, you're going to eat that or what?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they're
use
they're
your
like
eyelid as a blanket.
Yeah, they're
a fly
evil.
Blanket.
But you got some great opportunities to talk with Afghanis who were just surprised to find these American journalists wanting to know what was going on and what they wanted to find out.
Everyone was pretty shocked that we just traveling through
us.
On our own, wearing dressed like Afghans. I mean, they definitely respected that and liked it. They, no matter what their opinion of America or what the government's doing, they're able to separate that. Where we have, I
more
think,
than,
more trouble.
More than us.
We have more trouble doing that, especially with, for instance, like Iranians.
Yeah.
But they, I think, because they haven't had any government that you could even remotely consider representative. You could argue about ours, of course, but theirs far less so. For most of, you know, everyone there, their entire lives, since the Soviets invaded at least, that they don't recognize the people of a country as being the same as their government. So they were happy to see us. And, you know, everyone around the world kind of has a strange relationship with America. They hate our government, but they love Americans and American culture and music and food and all that stuff. So they liked us.
And you tried to hook up with a fixer from your trip in 2001, Ted, and just the vagaries of what's been happening over the war years out in this is not near Kabul. This is out on the northern frontier.
Yeah, this is Talakan, Tekhar province, which is in the northeast, and it's now really Taliban-held territory, but at the time it wasn't. It was very much in Northern Alliance hands. It's an ethnically Tajik area, which is always been anti-Taliban. And I kind of kick myself for being so stupid as to think I could find a guy based on his first name. Especially Joveed is like Jim.
I think when you first asked it, they started laughing. They're like, Joveed, yeah. What? And you're like, Joveed. They're like, I mean, it would be like coming to Portland and, yeah.
Looking for Matt.
Yeah.
By the way, I love that all these provincial Afghanis all speak English. So many of them speak English.
A lot of them do. We had trouble. We went places sometimes where we couldn't communicate with people. It was kind of difficult. But what we usually do is would find somebody that spoke good English.
Hey, we're cartoonists, too. Yeah. We drew pictures a lot.
Yeah.
You know, like we'd be like, for instance, with the meat. Remember we like went to look for sausage?
Yeah.
And it was like we didn't know what was in the sausage. So we were like drew like horse,
pig. And we just had
and,
them
like,
point.
It was
cow.
Horse. It was horse, by the way.
Yeah. They just had them. We were just like, what's this? And they're like, point to the pig. We'd be like, okay, we want that one, not the horse.
Although, I don't know, horse sausage could be good.
But as far as speaking English, everyone under, you know, 20 seems like they speak English. Like, all the children are going to school, they learn English. We ran into a six-year-old in Kabul. He spoke English better than six-year-olds here. It was amazing.
It's really great to be from a country that is wildly imperialistic.
Yeah.
And pushing the rest of the world around. It's very convenient, you know. I mean, can you imagine being like, say, from Paris? Well, you know, Zimbabwe. It's like, sorry.
Yeah. You know? No one knows what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, you're listening to Words and Pictures on KABU. I'm your host, SW Konser, and we're talking with Ted Rall and Matt Bors, who just spent the month of August in Afghanistan, where they blogged in comics form on their sites. And Ted, you're just talking about imperialism. This, one of the great stories from your blog that fascinated me, and I'm a huge fan of the epic John Huston film, The Man Who Would Be King.
Uh-huh.
It's from a Rudyard Kipling story. Moikel Kine and Sean Connery, as British Freemasons, they're part of the occupational force. Now this story, this Rudyard Kipling story, is based on an adventurer named Josiah Harlan. He was an American, a Quaker in the 19th century. He was the first American in Afghanistan, and he declared himself Prince of Gore, the province of Gore.
More than declared himself, it was actually he got it legally, like from an emir in Kabul in exchange for his assistance.
So Gore becomes Kafiristan in The Man Who Would Be King.
Right.
Because it is the middle of this country, Afghanistan being the what they call it, the graveyard of empires. The middle of this country is this very, and this is an area you went through, was Gore.
It's the most, even by Afghan standards, it's some of the most remote and supposedly wild and lawless, although the town was relatively calm.
You said biker gangs were running the place.
Well, that was up, that's up north, that's more up north. So, and also in the south. No, I mean, Chagchiran's like a little island of relative safety.
And, you know, had Ted, Stephen, and I been appointed emperors of Gore, we would not be sitting here right now.
That's true.
We would have stayed.
Except we would have had to declare jihad against the flies.
Yeah. Well, the descendants of Josiah Harlan might have lasted longer as princes of Gore if the British hadn't tried their hand.
Well, by the way, I was reading on Wikipedia, which must be so. It must be true that his heir is alive. He was an obscure actor. Yes, it is Matt.
I need to reclaim my throne.
He's an actor.
The throne of Gore.
The dude's like an actor.
You need to be a Freemason first.
I can't remember if it's Day of the Dead or Dawn of the Dead, but one of those two films, he was an actor in. And that guy is the Prince of Gore.
Oh, wow.
Except as some expert said, it would be a brave man who would try to make that claim stick.
Now, I'm not sure you intended to go through Gore. You certainly didn't intend to go to Kabul originally.
No, nor Gore, for that. Well, actually, that's not true.
Yeah, we wanted to drive through there. But we didn't plan on staying for days, but I'm glad we did.
Yeah, we intended originally to enter from the north, which we did. And then basically we did Talakan, Kunduz, Mazar. We intended to do those.
And you can look at a map, by the way, at tedrawl.com of the trip. And, you know, how it was intended and how it actually came.
Yeah. Exactly. So that was different. And then we ended up we wanted to go west along the northern highway, which goes through Maimana and then on to Herat. But it just wasn't possible. There was a reporter from the Washington Post who had gone ahead of us by about a day and a half. And he encountered, I think barely escaped with his life, the Taliban bike gangs from hell.
Yeah.
And so he like turned and we emailed him to find out, you know, his story. And he was like, don't go. You can't go. So we drove instead to Kabul. Then we were stuck there for 5 days. We didn't want to go to Kabul.
We were trying to get drivers.
People think Kabul is the one really safe place.
I can
only talk from one story that I've heard from an Afghani living in Portland here, but he was working for one of the government agencies in Kabul and basically left the building 10 minutes before the whole place blew up.
Yeah, no, it's probably the most dangerous place, and in some ways maybe safer than others. I mean, it just depends on how you're traveling. It's hard to say. Every place in Afghanistan is safe until it's not. I mean, I don't know, and it's also dangerous. You know, there's blast walls, cops everywhere, you know, but at the same time, that's where everybody's targeting, so
Kabul is an armed camp. So, you know, I mean, it's weird because, you know, with Westerners, I mean, it's almost like arguing about whether God exists or not. You're going to get two very fervent opinions about it. Like, you know, I mean, Americans and other Westerners argue about what's safe, what makes you safe. And, there's two personality types. There's people who think, you know, if I'm behind blast walls, you know, guarded by guys with huge guns and a gun nest and sandbags, I'm safe. And then there's other people. And to me, I think that I'm a target. I feel unsafe being in there. And I feel more safe being low-key, living with a local family, dressed like a local, with a beard, and nobody, not that many people know I'm there, but no protection. I feel safer. But it all depends. Like, I think discretion is more important than walls, but other people think walls are more important.
Yeah, I think I felt – I mean, there were some sketchy moments, but I felt – pretty safe the entire trip, even though we were completely on our own. But somebody could have walked into our hotel room, especially in Chagchiran, where there was zero security and bullet holes in our windows.
There wasn't even a door.
There were bullet holes in the windows, so somebody had already been whacked in there.
That's true.
You know, I mean, we could be dead, and then we wouldn't be here, and everybody would be talking about the stupid American cartoonists who thought they were going to travel through Afghanistan. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is it's really easy to try to second-guess people. Like, you know, the major event that had occurred just prior to our arrival was the murder of 10 NGO workers for that Christian aid charity.
Wasn't that Mercy Corps? No, it was a different outfit, I forget
the name of it. But they were Christian. They were, and it happened up in Badakhshan province.
And they were not, you know, the evangelical type. They were just the.
There's some controversy about that.
Okay.
Yeah, apparently the Taliban found a Bible in Dari among their possessions.
But come on. I mean, according to the Taliban.
Right.
I mean, I don't know that hey, they disclosed it.
No, I mean, who knows? They could have lied, but it also, I have to say, though, I always wonder what the hell a Christian charity would want to, why would they want to be in a country
God's
that is
work.
100%
Muslim?
Why would
Muslim? A cartoonist but, want to be in Afghanistan?
Yeah, but we're not there to try to change anybody's minds or get them to ditch their religion.
Well,
you
I don't know. You know, I don't well,
what
know.
Were
I
mean, you there for?
Fun. Partly.
The well, food.
Yeah, we're there for the flies. No.
To see how, you know, things have been going 9 years into the war. I mean, that's my entire adult life. We've been in Afghanistan. I turned 18 a few days after 9/11. So pretty much my entire adult life, we have occupied that country. And everyone knows it's not going well. There's basically no way out. I've been reading about it, thinking about it, drawing about it for almost a decade. You know, our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq is what propelled me into political cartooning. And so I wanted to go see it for myself.
And Matt Boris, some of your cartoons of Afghanistan are available at the Oregonian website. One of the blogs is on the Oregonian site. And,
yeah.
Ted, you're on the LA Times website?
Yeah, LA Times and EurasiaNet.org.
Yeah, the best way to find it would be go to OregonLive.com and just type in my name, Matt Boris, B-O-R-S. And I wrote a piece for him about 750 words, and then they printed some of my sketchbook pages and comics.
And did they give you any of the cash money to report back from Afghanistan?
No, I kind of went without any idea of how I was going to make money from the trip. I solicited some donations online. I got about $1,000 worth to help me buy supplies. But no, I just I was filing work with my syndicate, so it was running in all the papers that already pay me. I scored that work with the Oregonian, and I'm actually doing some longer pieces for a website called vjmovement.com that's going to come out in early November.
And, you know, I have to needle you a little bit. You're a cartoonist in your 20s.
Yeah.
And you decided in this 21st century to become an editorial cartoonist for daily newspapers. That's an interesting bit of timing on your part.
Well, what else am I going to do? Get a job? I mean,
are there any of those?
Yeah. I know everybody else I know that went to school and, you know, paid $100,000 for a degree, a bachelor's or a master's is, you know, still bartending, unfortunately. Editorial cartooning may be doomed, but it seems that everything else is too. I mean, I don't know. There's nothing else I want to do. Unfortunately, it's not, you know, I wish I wanted to be a lawyer. I'd be making more money, but I don't want to be a lawyer.
So. I remember
a bankruptcy lawyer.
Yeah.
I remember reading a story by Mike Peters, the Mother Goose and Grimm cartoonist, who's also an editorial cartoonist. And he was actually a big influence on you, Ted. He was talking about newsroom culture when he started back in the 70s. And I think people nowadays still have an overly romantic view of newspaper culture, like it's something out of Lou Grant or All the President's Men. But in the modern age, most newspaper contributors are freelancers now. And, you know, they're rarely found in actual newsrooms, let alone clustered around the water cooler.
Yeah, no, that's true. I still dream of working at a newspaper. And it will always be a regret that I have not gotten that opportunity. Unless I do. I mean, I would love that. I would really feel like it was the pinnacle of a career. Even if I worked at a small newspaper, it wouldn't really matter. It doesn't have to be, you know, the New York Times, but just anywhere.
So even with your Rush the Ramparts ideas about a revolution in this country, you still like these beautiful old institutions that we have.
Well, you know, to be human is to be full of internal contradictions, you know. So, you know, I mean, like, you know, I want to overthrow the capitalist system and replace it with a dictatorship of the proletariat, but I would really miss Banana Republic because they make the shirts that fit me best, you know.
You know, is it just me or have you noticed a serious dumbing down of editorial cartoons nowadays? You know, not to mention a distinct rightward shift in the political leanings of the artists who are still being hired. I mean, like last month, we lost a legend, Paul Conrad, who spent 30 years as the chief editorial cartoonist for the L.A. Times. And when he retired, you know, who replaced him? I think it was Michael Ramirez,
well,
total reactionary.
He didn't retire. He was fired. He was pushed out. And he was replaced by Mike Ramirez. I guess my understanding of that down at the Times was that there was sort of a civil war between the Chandler family and the other owners of the paper, and that Mike came in sort of as a result of the temporary triumph of the right-wing branch of the ownership. But the generally, I mean, certainly, I think that the state of editorial cartooning has it's interesting. There are definitely, on average, far more really good editorial cartoonists than there used to be. People like Matt, Jen Sorensen, Tom Tomorrow, Ruben Bowling, Stephanie McMillan, etc. But the problem is that those really good cartoonists are who might have ended up at newspapers in the past are either just on their own websites or at very small newspapers or alt weeklies. So there's more good cartoonists than ever before. I mean, you know, one Jen Sorensen is worth like 50 old style editorial cartoonists. But the thing is that now the major the big work goes to, like, you know, really bad, like, the new hires when they happen in general, there have been exceptions, have gone to the worst of the worst. And if you look at the work that's rewarded, like in the roundups, for instance, you know, I mean, it's like stuff that appears like in the New York Times on Sunday or in Newsweek. It's dog shit.
I wouldn't agree with you that it's that there's a rightward shift. I just think that it's the stuff that gets attention on most of the stuff that gets awards and gets reprinted, like Ted said, is just like lame, pedestrian, doesn't challenge anything that's going on. I mean, cartoonists like to talk a big game about editorial cartoonists like to talk themselves up as like they're champions of free speech and speak truth to power, but most of them are really just pro-establishment,
and they're often glorified gag cartoonists.
Yeah, and they're just regurgitating conventional wisdom. There's a big problem.
That's what they always say. Like, well, you guys are all, you talk about hard hitting, but like, you know, cartoons should be funny. I'm like, well, yeah, cartoons should be funny, and you're not even funny. You're nothing. You're just stupid.
Well, I saw you both this summer at the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists convention here in Portland. Our pal Jack Oman from the Oregonian was responsible for bringing cartoonists from all over the country to here. And Ted, you were until very recently the president of that august institution,
hadn't found me with that intern.
I mingled with these people, and they were just like icons. I love this, but they're all kind of looking like they're ready to retire for the most part, the guys there.
Let's hope so, because maybe some jobs will open up for Matt and I. I mean, I'm 47 years old. I've never been offered a job. I mean, I really want one. Matt deserves a job at a paper, you know? Years ago, there would have never been – Matt would have been hired – a guy with Matt's talent would have been hired at the age of 21, right out of college.
Right. Well, that's how Jack Oman got – early 20s, he got
I think he was 19.
Over. Yeah. Wow. 1983, he was 19. That was the year I was born.
That's amazing. And he did an amazing job, by the way, Jack Oman, bringing all these folks out here. That was just a huge labor, but
Jack's awesome. I consider him.
Tell us about what happens when editorial cartoonists get together.
Well, we drink beer and bitch about editorial cartooning, like we're doing now, minus beer.
Yeah. Do you have any beer? It's mainly about the drinking. I mean, you know, the thing that's really weird, also, see, it's that human contradiction thing is. Some of my really best friends draw really terrible cartoons, but they're, you know, even really bad editorial cartoonists are still really interesting, smart, well-informed, funny people. So it's always a pleasure to hang out with them and shoot the shit. It's awesome.
Yeah. You know, it just seems like a controversy is something that you've talked about this. You've talked about how controversy among cartoonists shouldn't be something that's dampened. It should be something that's out in the open. And, you know, forgive me for wondering if sometimes you get a rush from some of the hate that comes your way, but you're notorious for courting controversy, not just in political circles. We've had Art Spiegelman here on the show, and Art seems to think you were sent to test him, you know, like Job in Hebrew scriptures.
No, I sent a big whale to eat him, but I don't think it arrived. I didn't know Art thought so highly of me as thinking of me as being divinely inspired or something. But, I do think that it's weird how cartoonists don't have enough respect for their own profession to sort of demand standards and argue about what they ought to be enough to be able to say in public what they say over beers, which is, you know, that guy sucks. His work is terrible. Because that process is something that exists in all other art forms. You know, I mean, whether it's playwrights or actors or, you know, you name it, you know, the fine arts. People, you know, there's these famous literary feuds with, you know, Norman Mailer and people like that. And they're, you know, those elevate those professions because it's about like trying to push forward and say like, you know, this kind of work is good, this kind of work is bad. And if you're not allowed to say, you know, like if Art Spiegelman was not allowed to say Tedrall sucks and here's why, or if I'm not allowed to say the reverse, then, I mean, you know, because we all have to be nice to each other. Well, I mean, cartooning is always going to be this incredibly insular form. And, I mean, I think that, you know, like Tom Spurgeon's law, right, like 90% of everything, of all comics suck, is too generous. It's like, it's 99.99%, a higher percentage of comics suck than say, music. And, you know, if you look at, like, say, the lists of people who win, say, the Harvey Awards or the Eisners, and, you know, it's embarrassing the quality level of a lot of this work that's critically acclaimed in our profession. I mean, we're just not being held to high standards. And, you know,
well, that's the constant carping of not just cartoonists, but comics fans that say over in France or the Netherlands or Japan, there's just this respect that's not here. And cartoonists are seen as cultural figures that are worth listening to. Well, you're one of the few cartoonists who's been a guest on Bill Maher's TV shows, Politically Incorrect and Real Time. And Bill Maher, in fact, wrote an introduction to your book, To Afghanistan and Back.
That's right. In fact, I'll probably be back on Bill Maher's show next season. We've been talking to them about that. So, yeah, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, cartoonists were, you know, people like Mike Peters would appear like on Good Morning America routinely. And, you know, all these, you know, cartooning was far more mainstream. And I think that part of the reason that we're not as important anymore is because we don't think of ourselves as important. The profession has sort of become more dorkified, you know, where it's like cartoonists are – I mean, I kind of blame guys like Seth and people like that who kind of like – play up the whole like, oh, we stay in our rooms by ourselves and we don't have dates and we don't like, you know, we're all insecure and we're sit at home and jerk off kind of mentality. Because
yeah,
that's a bad
confessional comic has really gone downhill over the decades, I think, since the days of Crumb and Linda Barry and all.
We were rocks, like comics guys were like Bill Malden. They were rock stars. They dated celebrities. You know, I mean, it was like things.
That's what I want, damn it.
Well, I'm just saying it was like they were.
What celebrity do you want?
Like Charles Schulz was a celebrity.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, even someone like Bill Keane was a celebrity. And things have really kind of really gone down.
Strangely.
Like Chester Gould. And like now it's like, you know, it's kind of like how it's the same things happen to music. You know, if you show up like on stage dressed like a bunch of guys who are here to work on the, you know, replace the shingles on your roof. You know, no one's going to respect you. You got to look good. You should respect your public image. And, you know, cartoonists don't do that. They're like, oh, we're like you, but less so.
Especially in editorial cartooning, there's a tendency for everybody to just, especially publicly, say, everybody's great. You know, like, this guy's great. He's brilliant and everybody. No.
He's not.
He's not.
There's
Most
only
the
a few really good cartoonists.
Like, well, there seems like there's fewer and fewer than 20. Anyway. 20 years ago, there were a couple hundred, and now you're down to 50 or 60 in the daily papers.
Personally, I don't think that.
But there's more cartoonists than ever in the AAEC.
But how many editorial cartoonists could do five on in America, how many editorial cartoonists can do five decent editorial cartoons a week? You know, if the income were there to provide them with a job. You know, even great cartoonists like Tom Tomorrow, Jen Sorensen, I mean, they're doing one a week and they're usually pretty good. They can focus on that kind of quality. But who can do five, like, decent, passable to great editorial cartoons a week? Far less than the amount that are actually working doing it. I mean, it's probably not more than 10 people are even capable of that.
Yeah, passable. Yeah, we're not talking about like great, just like, you know, competent.
And I do 2 to 3 a week, so I'm saying that, you know, doing 5 a week would be hard. You have to, your quality goes down. You have to react faster than news, draw them faster, everything like that. But there's not that many people that are that great, in my opinion.
Well, you've been listening to a special uncut, unedited, web-only version of...
Uncivilized.
Uncivilized version of Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. My guests this morning have been Ted Rall and Matt Bors. They're back from a month in Afghanistan where they blogged in comics form. You can see those blogs on TedRall, RALL.com, and Matt Bors, BORS.com. Before you guys go, let's mention the books again that are just out. The Anti-American Manifesto by Ted Rall and War is Boring by David Axe and Matt Bors. Actually, there's lots more pictures in War is Boring than in your new book, Ted.
Well, that's because Matt draws better than I do. So it just seemed like the right way to go.
You're very wordy this time, Matt, but you've been doing your scratchboard style again.
Yeah. My publisher wanted it to hearken to the Communist Manifesto, which the original edition, which I didn't have, but the original edition had these really cool old
You don't have an original edition of the Communist Manifesto?
You know, I kind of want
that,
one.
You know,
he has
that makes
one.
Me question your credentials as a...
Well, it's true. I had a cheap, like, Penguin reprint, but... he had one. It was actually really awesome. It's beautiful,
cool.
You know. But
seems like it's more punk to have a Penguin reprint somehow.
Well, especially mine's like got pages torn out of it and stuff. I don't know why. Like, I really need page 104 out of the Communist
Roll
Manifesto.
A joint out of it?
Who knows?
And Matt, what can you tell us about Civil Discourse, the comic you've drawn for the ACLU's website, Stand Up?
Well, it's over.
Oh, it's over? So you and the ACLU have parted ways.
No, I do work for them. I do illustrations occasionally and stuff. But yeah, they did have me do a biweekly strip for about 2 years that was great because they were one of the places that were actually paying for original cartoons. And there's not a lot of places online that do that. Unfortunately, it's not a continuing gig.
And you occasionally do locally themed comics for the Oregonian these days.
Yeah, whenever I have time and whenever they accept my sketches, I like to do local issues for the Oregonian. It's pretty cool. I like to do local cartoons because you know that, you know, I've drawn Sam Adams and Randy Leonard and all these people, and they're reading the Sunday Oregonian, so they're seeing the cartoons that I'm making fun of them. I like it.
I'm, you know...
It's the power of political
cartoons. We've got, you know, the pals over there, like you've got Jack Oman you hang out with, and my pal Mike Russell does the Culture Pulp cartoon, and, you know, I have to give the Oregonian a little bit of cred for local content when it comes to the arts, at least.
Yeah, and hey, you know, say
more
what you
so than the, more so than the Mercury or Willamette Week.
Say
right?
What you want about the Oregonian, I'm not responsible for all the content in there. I can only speak to my own, but they pay pretty good for me to do a local editorial cartoon, and that's, you know, more than just getting things printed or getting exposure, which is like the model in the online world, is actually paying journalists and cartoonists to do work, and that model, for the most part, is still a giant newspaper that is able to have those kind of resources.
That's right. Ted, you used to be in Willamette Week.
Yeah, it got purchased by the Borg, known as Village Voice Media, and they canceled all their comics.
Ironic, because Village Voice is where Pfeiffer broke out and a whole bunch of...
Well, it's not the same company anymore.
Yeah,
it's the name. It's Village Voice in name only. It's New Times Corporations, based in Phoenix, bought Village Voice, the Village Voice, yeah, and then renamed the entire chain Village Voice Media. So really,
all
it's these like
former,
libertarian right-wingers from Arizona.
Former alt-weeklies are now lifestyle rags.
Well, I was running in The Voice at the time of the merger and... in the collapse of the economy, and they, all of them shrunk in size and page count, and they axed my comics for sure.
New Times / Village Voice is like a really incompetently run company. I mean, even so, like they had economic challenges to begin with, but I think they could, seriously, it could have been the go-go 90s and they'd probably be out of business soon because they're such idiots.
And Ted, for listeners who'd rather read a heartwarming story of struggle and survival and romance on the streets of New York City in the 1980s, you also have a graphic novel out, written from your own experiences as a college student and illustrated by Pablo Callejo. It's called The Year of Living Dangerously. Year of Loving Dangerously.
Loving, yes. That's right. The Year of Loving Dangerously. So, yeah, if you don't like my artwork, but you still care about me for some reason, this would be the book to pick up, because Pablo's artwork is really amazing.
And
it's
if you're
beautiful.
Just really strangely interested in heterosexual sex life.
That's true. Yeah. Why would you be interested in that? Actually,
although what's in the book is pretty interesting.
Yeah. No. And in fact, there's
we'll sleep with women for rent is basically
not even for rent, just for a place to crash.
Yeah. I think that's the future model for editorial cartooning.
An unlocked fridge.
How I'm gonna afford to live.
Yeah, I remember, like, you know, you've hit bottom when you're stealing socks out of the girl's house where you're crashing.
I'm glad things are looking up for you nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't have to steal socks. Yeah,
Ted has girl socks on, girl panties.
Yeah, that's the year of loving dangerously, part two.
That would be terrible if in Afghanistan that was the way you ended up
having to steal shalwar kameezes out of the steel burkas.
So yes, the blogs on Afghanistan in August. Ted Rall and Matt Boris, give us the websites again.
You can just go to rall.com, RALL.com, and it's a little hard to find. But if you just go to the blog, then you click on Central Asia, you will see the little slideshow of the 47.
You must
Afghan
know where Afghanistan
blogs.
Is.
And I'm at mattboris.com, BORS.
Thanks for joining us here on Words and Pictures. It's been great to have you both. Come back anytime. And thanks to all our listeners.
All right, man. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kant.